kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 82, with me, Doug Belshaw, and him,
Di Barnes. Good evening.
Hello, how are you doing, Di?
I am pretty good. So I'm in the busiest sort of 2 weeks of my working year, 2 or 3 weeks, and so it's because all the coursework that we do in computer science has to go away at this time. So the marks had to go away on Monday. So it's been a really busy 2 weeks, and then we have to get the portfolios ready for electronic submission tomorrow. So busy times. Shouldn't be here. I am here. Let's get on.
Okay, let's crack on then. I would say let's keep it a short one, but that never happens.
It's true.
I've just turned off that selfie light that we were using when we had the video on, when we were just kind of messing about before we hit record.
It's an awesome little gizmo, that is, I think.
Yeah, so how would I describe it? You describe it as like being like a paperclip.
Yeah, so it's a light, it's a bright light, LED driven, I imagine, that clips on. It costs you a fiver, is that right?
Yeah, from Amazon, something like that. So it's a couple of AAA batteries. So this was recommended in Christian Payne's Pre-Thinking Digital live streaming workshop. So Christian Payne is documentally on Twitter and elsewhere and has a great newsletter. And I was really looking forward to his live streaming workshop. And it went on for 3 hours. And I went back on Twitter to be able to live stream things on Periscope, etc.
All right. Okay. Well, so that sounds really interesting. Want to hear more? I did some live streaming this week of a table tennis tournament, the 2 semifinals and the final of a table tennis tournament from the basement of our head teacher's house.
So just stop you there. Last week, we were talking about this, and you weren't sure whether you were going to live stream it or do highlights.
That's right. So I went with the live stream in the end because it's contained within itself. There's no post-edit. But the guy, our AV guy, wasn't here, so I had to set it all up. And I woke up bolt upright in bed at 6:30 in the morning thinking, oh, I've promised to do that, and I have no idea how to do it. So I spent half
the
day.
So what did you use to stream it?
Subscribed to eStream. So we paid to have eStream, which is a video platform and digital signage platform in our school. And as part of their offering is a live streaming service possibility. So you have to. So I got the expensive camera, which is Canon FX100, and stick it into a decoder, into a computer. The computer has to be wired, not wireless. So I have to run leads to it, and then it just live streams. It has an app. iStream have an app that encodes it and puts it out.
Who wanted to watch it had to log in.
No. So it was public outside of our network and log in within our network. So that's how live streaming works. And so we only had like. 60-odd people watching it, but
well, it's a bit of a niche sport.
And it's quite difficult. You've just got one camera, you're not zooming in, and it's not lit or anything like that, you know. So the quality of it isn't brilliant, but you do get into the thing, and the quality of the final. So the whole point of like doing sport, in my opinion, of watching sport anyway, is to be in the presence of, to spectate a really competitive sporting occasion, you know, a drama. And the final was that between two boys called Julian and Ryan, and they were just amazing. Oh, and cool. The quality of table tennis was superb.
Well, talking about things being lit, so Christine shared some things which were quite expensive, but also some things which were like free apps, and also some things which were very cheap, like this selfie light. So there's lots of different versions of this on Amazon. I just chose the one that popped up as bestseller. I think it was slightly more, it was like £6.80 or something. Anyway, so what it is, it's like a circle. Half of the circle is filled in and has the battery space. Half of it is completely see-through. So when you clip it on, you can clip it over the top of the camera and the camera looks through this hole. Then all the way around the outside, it has LEDs. And then when you press the button, there's 3 levels of brightness, which obviously then gives you the perfect circle light in the person's pupils. So it works really, really well.
It's based on the principle of a very expensive light ring that you attach to the front of your camera. And you don't have to have that because you've got this little gizmo that effectively does the same thing but improves the quality of what you take pictures of or taking pictures of people on your mobile phone. Mm-hmm.
So because it's like a paperclip, you can literally just clip it onto your phone or monitor or whatever. So, yeah, I'm really, really pleased with that. And also, it's probably worth mentioning, and I'll put the link in the show notes, an app called Stitcher Go. Now, one, as I was saying to you earlier, Di, the value of doing this, of going to workshops with people who are walking the walk, is that you get the shortcuts to the really good stuff. Because obviously, if you type in a live stream app into any app store, you're going to get a million results. Wow. So this particular one, what did I say it was called?
Switch-A-Go,
that's right. What it allows you to do is to pre-record your live stream. So you can pre-record the whole thing and then stream it out as if it was live. You can also pre-record bits of it, so you can then stream it live and then put bits that you've pre-recorded into it. Let's say you're demoing something with your hands and you wanted to get it absolutely right. And then you can also put like a little ident on it, like a little logo and stuff. And it's free, uh-huh. And it supports YouTube Live and Facebook Live as well. So that's pretty good.
Cool. And one of the things I noticed, actually, I was listening back to last week's episode, I think, when I was driving in the car down to London. And I noticed that your voice is dominant over mine, and it comes up much crisper and clearer. Mine sounds a little muffled and dull in the background. So I'm talking closer to my microphone this week to try and remedy that for anybody who dares to listen to
me. No, I put that in post-processing. I make sure that I'm dominant. It's also because I'm recording it through my Skype. I think, you know, if you recorded it on your Skype and my Skype, and we've mixed the two together.
Yeah, that's exactly why it is, I think. But that's the way it goes. So I'm just mentioning that. Just trying it a little bit.
No, I've noticed that when I listen back to it, one of the reasons I listen back to it is because in the heat of discussion, as it were, sometimes I actually miss some of the things that you say and the remarkable insights that you have. Sometimes I realize I'm actually talking over the top of you, so I do apologize for that.
No, that kind of happens. And I've noticed that in digital tools, actually, more than on the telephone. So when you're on a telephone, a normal landline speaking, when someone else is talking whilst you're talking, you can both hear each other and that's going on. But I think when you're doing it digitally, it's not the case. So quite often I'll be talking to someone on a digital tool over the internet, and I'll be talking to them and they don't know because they're just talking at me and I'm trying to interrupt them, but they can't hear me. Mm. So there's obviously some noise balance thing or something going on, or just dominance of audio feed. I don't know.
Cool. So, the Thinking Digital Conference, a couple of things I've done since we last spoke. I went into the Lake District on Sunday and Monday. Sunday was very sunny and lovely and ice cream weather and sunglasses and lovely. And then Monday was, I was expecting this, 40-mile-an-hour winds, -5 with wind chill, torrential rain all the way through, really bad visibility, really struggled. Was using walking poles for the first time, which I bought on Sunday night, and was like, it really made a difference. I'd highly recommend them. But then I was coming down a crag, and I hadn't secured them properly, and they, when I put it down, it went back in, like it what's the word? It went back into itself, uh-huh. And then I slipped and fell down this crag, and if I'd hit my head, I don't think I'd be here now. But fortunately, I kind of, when I was younger, I did judo, and I kind of instinctively rolled, and so I hurt my...
Yes, knowing how to fall, that's it, with style.
Well, I'm not sure it was style, but I only hit my hip and my elbow, and so I'm remarkably okay. But you know, when you're just lying there, and you're like, get up. So I got up and got back to the car, and you know, had a bit of a miserable day, but I did it and I wrote it up, and that was that.
Superb. I was thinking, because I saw your tweets about that, and we had a little text message exchange, didn't we?
Yeah.
And in the week, and I was giggling to myself at your because you were proper Bear Grylls, and I was thinking there should be a multiplier for your mountain days, like someone who's just cruised through the mountain days. And so one of my pupils, one of my tutees, was on Gold D of E. Yeah. And his choice was to go on the catacanoes that I talked about for they used a couple of weeks ago, and to travel down the river. But their team leaders had set them off downstream, and they just happened to get some days of good weather. So they were just sitting downstream, not having to paddle very hard, all their kit on this net in the middle of the two canoes, and then getting off and camping. And the weather was beautiful, so it was just like a dream. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a challenge at all. And I thought there should be some kind of multiplier that is authenticates the difficulty of your experience. So you were doing mountain days, and you know, a mountain day in ice cream weather is, you know, has its challenges, but it's nothing like what you had the day after.
Possibly, but I'm doing this for my own benefit, so it's actually pretty good to know what to do. I also managed to leave my compass in the car, which was a very stupid thing to do on a day of low visibility, because obviously I had to check my map and where I was going. Uh-huh. At one point, I was absolutely convinced I was going the wrong way and was just about to turn around when I recognized kind of a contour and a wall. And then one bit, I went over a stile and almost fell off a cliff. Which was quite interesting, but so you're supposed to do 5 days. Yeah, sorry, 5 hours above a certain height.
Yeah.
Well, that day, I ended up doing 4.5 hours because I just didn't stop. I just ate on the go and stuff, and I was absolutely drenched and I was miserable. But I am arguing that 4.5 hours counts because that was hard work.
That's what I'd say. That's what I mean. The point of challenge is when it's hard, you need a multiplier for the hours that you spent up there It's such a different experience.
It is.
The things that you must have gone through internally in your mind, dealt with physically, that you came up against and combated, all of those have got to be worth more than your ice cream day by a long chalk.
You see the guy in the newspaper who has got Alzheimer's and goes up a mountain in Coniston every day?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was all over the news. And
does he forget that he's gone up?
Sorry?
Does he forget that he's gone up each day?
Well, no, it's part of him, you know, kind of like delaying the effects of Alzheimer's, is that he goes up the same path every single day. Yeah?
Oh, okay.
Well, I didn't meet that guy, but I did meet a guy who was about the same age, so he must have been retired in his 60s, and I was going up on Sunday, lovely, glorious day, must have been just after 9 o'clock in the morning, and he was coming back down, and he had gone up there in the dark so that he was on top of the mountain for sunrise, which I thought was pretty hardcore.
Oh, that is pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
I saw another thing about Alzheimer's this week, actually, about a mid-teenage boy, late 17, I think. And he was working in this old folks' home, and one guy had Alzheimer's. And he just used to sit there. He didn't remember anyone, didn't know anything. It was like really hard to deal with. And then he was going through his stuff with him one day, and he came across that he used to be a pianist and play jazz in a band. Mm. And so he put out on social media, and I think it was, does anybody want to play with him? Let's try and get him. He brought a keyboard in. He got the guy's son to bring a keyboard in, and he could play. This guy could play. So, he was just sitting there pretty much doing nothing all day long. And now he was playing the piano, so he put out this article to get some players to play with him, and his original band members replied. So it ended up that they did a gig at the old folks' home outside, with this sort of jazz quartet, and he was just like rocking on it. He was still there. Wow. It sounded great. So
that's good to show, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting that doing that kind of thing, that guy combating his Alzheimer's with going up the mountain. There are things that you can do that keep you rocking on, I guess.
Good stuff.
What's next?
Have we spoke since my grandma's funeral? I don't know.
No.
Yeah, it was lovely, and it was a really nice day, and really good to see the family, and very positive and stuff, and. The funny thing that happened during it was a service at the crematorium led by a Methodist minister. She went to a Methodist chapel, and my dad had chosen the song in the middle, and the words were on the sheet, but they played "Abide with Me" instead, and everyone was like standing, not knowing what to do. And in the end, they just put it off. And then the vicar wove the words from the song that we didn't sing into his kind of like summing up at the end. And it was really beautiful. And I'd helped my dad with the eulogy. And so I knew it was coming. I was totally holding it together. I wasn't going to cry. And then that morning he'd changed the last paragraph. And obviously that just finished me off. So.
Did he go before you?
Oh, yeah.
So you were screwed. Oh, unlucky.
And I just read the psalm, and yeah, it was all good. But lots has happened since we last spoke, actually. So the Thinking Digital Conference I wanted to speak about just quickly. Uh-huh, because so usually when I go to a conference, Di, as you know, I have to travel all over the place. Mm-hmm. And this is such a high-quality conference, and it's on my doorstep. It's in Newcastle, on Gateshead at the Sage. And some of the stuff that I saw there, I mean... Wow. So I as soon as the tickets come out for the next year, I think I paid like 150 quid last year, and includes the conference dinner. And it's just unbelievable the people that you meet. I met a guy who spends his time between Hong Kong and Dubai, and he was using like blockchain to disintermediate lawyers and all this kind of stuff. Another guy who was in like biomedical stuff, there were HoloLenses, all this kind of stuff. People from DARPA were speaking. But the best thing was yesterday when Imogen Heap performed live.
Oh, wow.
So Imogen Heap, it turns out, I knew that she was doing the stuff on blockchain. I knew that she's, you know, that awesome artist and things. But I didn't realize that she was actually in one of my favorite bands back in the early 2000s, which was Frau Frau.
And
so I really enjoyed that album, just like straight up. And then I realized when she was singing this song, and I'll explain like why it was so amazing in a moment, that it was a Frau Frau song. And that made the connection. Anyway, what she's done with the help of technologists and whatever is she's trying to take back ownership and of her music and connection with her fans. So she worked with Vinay Gupta to do Ethereum smart contracts so that as soon as somebody buys her song or album, everyone who was involved in it gets paid immediately rather than up to 4 years they can take, apparently. But the amazing thing is she was wearing these gloves that went kind of halfway up towards her elbow on each hand. And they had some kind of electronics on them. And she said, I think there was a separate event where she explained them, but they were wirelessly connected to her laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all the sensors in, like on a Wii, like a Wiimote, like accelerometer and gyrometer and all this kind of stuff. And she had programmed gestures in her hands to do certain things to the music. So, for example, there was a bit where she clasped her hands and it recorded a bar of what she was singing then and then repeated it. Another one did reverb. There was one bit where she moved both of her hands from side to side and moved the music in the stage, like around the building of her voice.
Right. Yeah.
And it was like she was playing with her voice, with her hands in real time. It was one of the best things I've ever seen in my life.
Superb. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And it was going in real time.
And she's doing a tour next year where she wants to get these into production, get other artists being able to use them, all this kind of stuff, and get local people involved with the tour rather than just people coming into town and taking over, and just really, really inspiring. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And then just loads of other stuff, like one of the people who helped put the Curiosity rover on Mars, somebody who was trying to solve things like anxiety, depression, and insomnia through cognitive behavioral training on apps. There was a guy who was a 27-year-old white, privately school-educated guy who did freestyle rapping, but with any words that the audience mentioned. Who was hilarious. There's a social media guy. Just the range of stuff that the audience was exposed to was mind blowing. I highly recommend. I think that's my fifth one I've been to.
Superb. Sounds really, really good.
Mm.
Lots of interesting things. I mean, you can't argue with that. It's kind of food for the soul, hey?
It really was. It made me feel slightly inadequate, I have to say, because as somebody said, there's either a lot of survivorship bias here or I'm just really crap. Because people really at the top of the game.
Fair play.
Oh, the DARPA thing. We've talked about it just offline, but the DARPA thing was, and if you think about it, this is just what they can show you. It was a little 4x4mm sensor chip thing they could put in someone's brain or in the central nervous system. And they could then control things with their mind. And this was happening right now. So, for example, there was a paralyzed guy. He was paralyzed in a car crash. He shook Obama's hand with a robotic arm. There was another one who controlled an F-35 plane. It was a simulator, but all. And just, yeah. One guy could touch things. He was an amputee and could touch things again using fingers that he didn't have. Oh, man, it was freaky.
That's amazing, isn't it? You see, a lot of these things, I mean, it shows you how tech can be driven by war, I guess, mm. by bad things, mm. but still the actual processes going on within the tech are pretty amazing. As we've seen, advances in technology being used for bad, but in their essence, in their creation, their invention, they were used for good things, you know.
Indeed. So, yeah, you've put something here about the Yellow app. What's that?
One of our child protection officers brought it to my attention today, and some children in year 8 were using it. So basically, Yellow is an app for making friends on Snapchat and Kick and Instagram, I think. And although I don't know how you do the Kick thing, so I did a really and it's 13. There's a mixed report on it, and one of the reports I read said that if you put your age under 13, it automatically puts your age back over to 13, rather than saying you're too young to go on this service. It actually puts the age back up. However, you have to authenticate it with your mobile phone, so you have to have a mobile phone number, which gives it a little bit more accountability and things like that. So I downloaded it and had a go and sort of wondered what this was to see if I could spot any of our pupils using it and that kind of thing. And so I put myself, for the first time ever, I fraudulently declared myself to be 19 years old.
Did you swipe right on any people profile?
I did not. No, I didn't swipe right on any. But I did spend, you know, sort of 20 minutes, 25 minutes of a rabbit hole, just sort of looking at how young people, purportedly between the ages of 17 and 22, male and female, didn't just get one gender thrown at me, but mostly female, how they presented themselves online in a series of 5 or 6 pictures, because that's obviously not something, you know, I didn't really, it's like Tinder. It's exactly what it's like. And as you indicated, and so it was just sort of interesting. And then, and it's connected to Instagram profile, so you can check out the person that, you know, the person has to have a sort of deeper Instagram profile with lots more pictures in it. So you can kind of see who they are, looking at identity. It's location based again, but not, it's not particularly close. So it's not like around here. They're like in Leicester and places like that. And in
Perth. Oh, I see. Well, it depends. It depends how many people are using the app, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that kind of thing. So I was looking at that, but it's certainly one that I think the pupils could have. You need to discuss the risks, and that just to make sure that they realize that the people that they're swiping and then talking to and then joining on other social media platforms might.
It's funny how different who they say they are.
They might not be who they say they are. So you just have to, you know.
Yes, of course. Yeah. It's funny how different platforms have different demographics. You know, Snapchat, I feel like I. Not that I don't particularly want to use Snapchat, I don't really have a reason for it, but I don't think I know anybody who uses it regularly.
No, I don't interact with it regularly, and it has a bit of an error on my device anyway, actually. So okay. One of the buttons doesn't show up properly, and but you can get around that, but I can't be bothered. And but it is fantastically fun. So right. The filters you can put on it are hilarious.
I overheard a conversation in the supermarket randomly between a fireman and his friend. And obviously firemen have quite a lot of downtime, and he was saying that he just spends his whole time on Snapchat. He must have been in his 40s, 50s.
I think, it is actually sort of funny and compelling, and it's an interesting thing. So you sort of look at Snapchat and you think possibly fugly, you know, rather than going for painting yourself beautiful, it's kind of a fugly thing, and that's sort of accepted, and it's possibly why young people are liking it so much. And they use it, in my experience, they use it as a comms app, just talking to each other in the chat, not necessarily doing the pictures all of the time, and then send the odd picture or whatever. And boys don't send as silly pictures as girls do. Because the filters you can use are varied, and you have these things called streaks. So if you get a big long streak of high usage and lots of conversation and things like that, and people looking at your stuff, then that streak goes up, and losing your streak is a bad thing. You work on your streak to build it. Clever little tool by Snapchat.
Yeah, that is, isn't it?
I was speaking to in there. So I went for a drink after work. We were lucky enough to have a bar in our common room. So I had a local ale on draft. Thank you very much. Very nice. I had about 7/4 of a pint. And I was talking to a 22, 23-year-old gentleman who's a sports fellow here. And he has a massive streak of like 50,000 something going on. And he's using it all the time. And but everyone else was just like poo-pooing it at the bar. And face-to-face conversations, that's what it's all about. and they're all just kind of laughing about their own thinking it's stupid, but then there's a couple of people who say no, it's really funny, and then you get it out and you start putting the filters on people around the bar, and it is hilarious. People are laughing, saying no, I'd never use that, but they're laughing there.
I think we talked about it on one episode, but there was some research, and I'll be able to find it quickly, that said that there's a weird psychological phenomenon, especially amongst younger people, where they're more likely to trust somebody that they see represented on a screen as opposed to in real life.
Wow, isn't that interesting? I guess it's because it gives you a sort of distance and clinical way of checking them out. So anyway, I mean, Snapchat is Snapchat, and I think that's a fair point about that screen thing. You need to be wary of it. So the two concerns raised on the UK government's websites about it are, one is the obviously stranger danger that people are not necessarily who they purport to be, and it's like a gateway app to grooming, potentially, because you go and, you know, you think the person is who they say they are, and then you go and connect with them on another social media, and then it's location and text message or whatever, you know, potentially. And then it's body image as well. So interestingly, in the profiles that I was looking at, there's about sort of four or five pictures most people have put up on their profile, similar to Tinder, as far as I'm aware. And you have one picture, which is your first profile picture, and then you go through a series of others if you wish to. And so the profile pictures obviously paint the individual in a great light, and they look very what media society would call attractive. And then the other pictures go through various things with different Snapchat filters on that distort the face and hide different bits of them. But they're sort of very chosen for girls and boys. They choose to show their bodies in different ways, always in a positive light, depending on what the strengths of their bodies are. So these characteristics are shown. So it's something to be aware of for teachers, I think, and schools, is that this yellow app could be being used, and it seems distant because it is so transient. But if you do match people, then you start chatting with them like you would on Tinder, and then you go and move on to Snapchat when you think they're a sorted kind of person or whatever.
Right.
So
there was interesting. So one of the apps that was mentioned in the live streaming workshop was one called Lively, which I hadn't come across before. Uh-huh. So I'd come across, you know, Periscope and YouTube Live and Facebook Live and even Twitch, which is mainly used for games, but I think they're opening it out a bit more, and it's owned by Amazon now. But the one I hadn't come across was Lively, so it's live.ly.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd install that, have a good play, but it is like all of the videos I was scrolling through were all kind of girls in their late teens, I guess, and it just made me feel a bit like I shouldn't be looking at this. They weren't doing anything wrong. They were just, you know, or even lewd. They were just, you know, hanging out and doing stuff. It just didn't feel like I should be in that space somehow.
I felt that about the yellow thing, and I will delete it, but I'm just taking some screenshots of how the app behaves so I can show it to other teachers. And the sorts of things that are being put up there, and sort of looking for a pupil, but I've not found one, and I doubt I will. I do feel a little uncomfortable scrolling through all of these profiles. Quite glad there's boys in there as well, because it just kind of just makes me feel a little less inappropriate sort of thing. But these things must be done so that we know, so that we can educate and do whatever.
One thing which I've been thinking about recently is identity on the web. And I was talking to a lawyer, not the one I mentioned before, who wasn't actually a lawyer per se, but there was a lawyer from, it was a lawyer firm, began with a V in London, and they don't just represent the 1%, they represent the 0.1%, like celebrities. And the example he gave, I don't know if it's actually a client of theirs, but he said there's a real problem when, for example, a reporter will phone up their firm and say, "Hi, I'm Ryan Giggs's wife." And because of conflict of interest, they would then have to say, "Oh, I can't talk to you," and put the phone down, at which point the reporter knows that they're representing Ryan Giggs. So how do you do that identity piece? So he was talking to me about open badges and blockchain, and Vinay Gupta, who we mentioned before, about like cheap ID and genocide-resistant identification and all that kind of stuff. And it really is an issue. So on one hand, we want to have anonymity, we want privacy, we want different facets to identity. But then there's this really important piece, like we talked about last week with your purchase from Alibaba.
Yeah.
Where you do need to prove who you are, and it's really important that you can verify that you are Dai Barnes, and this is, you know, you can tie your online and your offline identity together.
We talked about this as well, didn't we? Using, because I had a conversation with my pupils about blockchain, using it for verifying identity kind of thing. Same thing.
Yeah, so this week I just wrote something about Keybase, because did we mention that last week?
We did not, no.
So Keybase is something I signed up for. Oh, a couple of years ago, I think I was still in Missoula, was I? When I can't remember. Maybe I've just left. But it seems to have had a resurgence, and I think mainly because it's now got native apps. It's not just a website. So Keybase is a place that you can not only verify that you are who you say you are on in different places. So your PGP key for signing email, like Twitter, Facebook, all different kinds of places, your Bitcoin ID, etc. But it's also in the app, you can send and receive files between people and have chat and things. So it's moving into more of a utility rather than just a verification check. And I thought it was definitely something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I'm just reading through your article. Oh, I see. PGP encrypt. Mm-hmm.
So Aaron Davis, hi Aaron, if you're listening, he just asked on Mastodon, he said, you know, so if this is a stupid question, but how is this different from kind of things like About Me? And I think that's an entirely legitimate question. About Me, obviously anyone can set it up. And in fact, if you go to my old About Me page, the one that I deleted, someone, because I had some Google juice, then basically squatted on that on that particular identity, and it links to, I think, gambling and casino sites now. And I actually used the EU right to be forgotten thing on Google to make sure that wasn't on the front page when people searched for me, which was an interesting thing. But obviously About Me, you can set it up and there's no proof. Whereas with Keybase, you have to verify your identity. So, for example, to prove that it's my, you know, DougBelcher.com is my website, I had to go into the server and put a particular key in there that they then checked for. Same with Twitter. I had to tweet something out, which then proves it's me, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, yeah, you've got sign-in keys for your devices as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm assuming a gobbledygook and of no use to anyone.
Yes. The only thing about Keybase, which I do say at the end of this article, is that I think a lot, you'll understand public and private key cryptography, Dai, but I think a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. And the thing that you need to know, the only thing you need to know really, is that you should never give someone else your private key. It's a really stupid thing to do. Whereas Keybase encourages you to give them the private key, which they say is, you know, encrypted, etc. But you should never, ever, ever, even if it's more convenient, to give someone your private key, because obviously then if it gets out, like with the, you know, NSA stuff, everything like that, people can pretend to be you on the internet, which is identity theft.
It is. Not allowed.
Mm.
Cool. So stir me into action a little bit then.
Well, just to finish this off, I'd be interested in anyone who is listening's kind of thoughts on this. There's this magazine called Stir to Action, and John Bevan, who's part of our co-op, had introduced me to this, but I'd never actually seen the printed version of it. So I thought it was just another kind of lefty magazine about changing the world. But when I went to the co-op, you know, the Open Co-op Platform Cooperatives Conference at Goldsmiths earlier this year, I actually picked up a few copies of it. And it's fantastic, the quality of it, in terms of the writing, the illustration, the coherence in terms of themes, that kind of stuff, is just really good. So they don't pay writers. It's, you know, it's exposure, it's all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, initially I'm not going to do that. But as soon as I saw it, I was like, yes, I do want to write for you. And actually I subscribed to the magazine as soon as I saw it, because it was that good. And so the editor, Jonathan, said, yes, we love an article from you. And so I have written one called Digital Employability for the New Economy. And it talks about digital literacies, the labor market, signaling, yeah, just all kind of open badges, everything like that. And so, Yeah, it seems like it's going to be accepted and go into an upcoming article, and if your upcoming magazine, and if you're interested in that, you can still review it, you can read what I've got, and yeah, just let me know what you think.
Cool. What an interesting idea.
Right then, shall we dive in?
Yeah. We've got a pretty much an education focus this week with some hacking in it.
Surely not. Education focus?
Yeah. We do have some stuff in there. So let's crack off then. Education can't fix poverty, so why keep insisting that it can?
Yeah, so this is something which politicians say all the time, don't they? So in this particular article, because it's American-focused, it's an interview between Jennifer Berkshire, who's the interviewer, and Harvey Kantor, who is the interviewee. And Harvey Kantor, it says, is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Education, Culture and Society at the University of Utah. And he's the co-author of Educationalizing the Welfare State and Privatizing Education, the Evolution of Social Policy Since the New Deal.
So I've read this, and I don't know where I've read it from, or I don't know if I've read this article, but I've certainly read this interview, or reported elsewhere maybe. But it's essentially saying, let's stop asking schools, asking the education system to fix things that it can't. And I think that not just poverty is in that bracket, really. But you always hear this in the national press in England, in UK, is that, you know, schools will go and do this and they will do it in PSHE and it will all be taken care of, kind of thing.
But, well, if you go through all the things that schools are supposed to be doing, so there's the prevent agenda, which is supposed to make schools and universities make sure that they're not harboring terrorists or all that kind of stuff. Also from mental health, social inclusion, reducing the attainment gap, and also just improving society, you know, just through education.
Citizenship, yeah.
Citizenship, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And he seems to really talk some sense.
Sex, supposed to be doing sex too, like sorting everyone's sex lives out.
And it's just impossible to do all this kind of stuff. And there's a paragraph in here which I really liked. Where is it? It says, if we really want to address issues of inequality and economic insecurity, there are a lot of other policies that we have to pursue besides, or at least in addition to, education policies. And that part of the debate has been totally lost. Raising the minimum wage or providing a guaranteed income, which the last time we talked about seriously was in the late 1960s. Increasing workers' bargaining power, making tax policies more progressive. Things like that are going to be much more effective at addressing inequality and economic security than education policies. That argument is often taken to mean schools can't do anything unless we address poverty first. But that's not what we're trying to say. End of quote.
Yes, so one of the big problems with this approach, as in going through schools, is that people can say, well, this is what we're doing about it. We have a national campaign to have this covered in schools, and it's covered in every single school in the country. And therefore, it's part of our policy. It's part of what we're doing to address this problem. But that's not necessarily true, because schools aren't in a position or don't have the resources to put behind it, as well as all the other things that they have to do to make a really good go of it, kind of thing.
That's right. And in the US and UK, which are the most neoliberal economies on the planet, education is now no longer this public good. Education is marketized. So education is something which you pay for as a commodity, and it's all to do with your economic power at the end of it. So it's almost like the government invests in education, which is then sold in some way to the individual, and it's their responsibility. So the upshot of it is basically, if you don't do well in life, it's your fault, which is not obviously always the case.
And no. It's the other way around. It's obviously not the case.
Yeah, indeed.
So that's that. In my opinion, that's the thing, is you can go and get an education and try your hardest, but still you're so disadvantaged by whatever it might be, by gender, race, religion, whatever it might be, that in a situation where it actually comes down to the crunch, as in the decision of whether you get employed or not, possibly, then you get not chosen because of these things. And we don't address that in schools.
To the Thinking Digital conference, actually. This guy came on stage, and the thing he was talking about was really cool, but he was spouting some absolute bollocks about organizations and stuff. And I don't know if you've ever heard people talk about what you want in the organization. There's two types of people. There's radiators and there's drains. And radiators make everyone around them feel great, and then drains just suck their energy out of it. And you've all know people like that. And and he literally had a slide of a Duracell bunny on the screen. And I'm thinking, I've worked for people like this, and they are absolutely hellish to work with, because they believe so strongly in, you know, I'm using little bunny ear scare quotes, cultural fit. That basically, if you're not like the Duracell bunny all the time, you know, then you're out.
And that is the point, isn't it? People are jagged profiles. They've got jagged edges, and they're different at different times of the day, of their life, of the week, of the month, or whatever. And they do different. They have different strengths. They're not all the same at certain points. They have different strengths, and those strengths are applied in different ways according to what's going on in their lives at that time.
Mm. So this the whole thrust of this article, this interview, is that, you know, we shouldn't. We like to think as educators that education is really, really important, and it is, but it can't affect systemic injustice. Like, you can point to one or two people who managed to overcome things despite their background and upbringing, but education by itself can't fix society.
I think that was a really interesting thing. So there were lots of really interesting examples of this, but I remember when Ireland was in lots of trouble, Northern Ireland, and I watched a documentary about how children in school would get along from different sides of the tracks, would get along, sort of Protestant and Catholic, but as they got older, they would learn to hate each other. So children that were once greatest of friends would grow up and be socialized to hate each other. So actually what was going on in the schools in the first place was all good and dandy, and it was society that sort of broke it. And I think society is complex. I have a good example. When I was in India, I was staying with some Jesuit priests in a church, and having a conversation with them about castes of Hindu. And I hope not to offend anyone in what I'm about to say. But I don't think I'm going to. So the four castes exist from head to chest to waist to feet. We talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah, I think we did.
Do you remember that?
Yes, I think so.
So you've got these four castes, and essentially the caste of people who are from the feet, as it were, are called, not so much anymore, but were called the untouchables. And they are the people in Indian society who are allowed to handle human waste and of all kinds, like bins and toilets and whatever. And the other castes are not. And so I was talking to the Jesuit priest, and he was saying it's not a good thing, and that there are changes going on now in India to address these prejudices in society, which are very ingrained because it's part of religious doctrine. But then talking, sort of pushing back at him a little bit, so I said, well, what about the Catholic Church, which is very big in India? How's it going in there? And he said, well, interestingly, bishops are only chosen from the head caste, sometimes from the chest, but mostly from the head caste. And that's an interesting method or an interesting illustration of how these indoctrinated prejudices can really be hard to break and to shift. And they feed. I mean, this is crossing over between two distinctly different religions, but still they feed, you know, the culture brings people's decision making at the crunch points to this ultimate situation of prejudice being rife, you know. And I think it's a little bit like that. However, I would say schools are a good place to discuss these issues. But I don't think schools are a policy. I don't think education should be used as a policy by which these issues are being solved. I think they should be solved by the grown-ups and not by the children who are going to be tomorrow's grown-ups necessarily. But I think the young people should be encouraged to think about these things and to discuss them.
We've talked about this before many times since EdTech Roundup days, but the Bank of England now has long been for years in the has controlled interest rates and things. And it used to be the government, the UK government, that controlled that. And why on earth the UK government, politicians, control education? I have no idea.
Well, yes,
I do know because it gives them lots of power, but it's
it gives them something to do, isn't it? So I mean, in all sort of large organizations that involve a lot of personnel, like education, like defense, like the police, etc., you would argue they would probably all want to take their decision making processes out of the hands of elected politicians who are transient in their positions rather than there for their lifetimes.
There's a ridiculous, I mean, you know this area, so you know what I'm talking about here. There's been the local elections, which, you know, are going to precede the general election. And there's been all over the country conservatives getting in because of the perceived weakness of Labour and the Liberal Democrats. And here in Northumberland, it's still, I think, a split council, but the conservatives got a lot more power. And the first thing that they pushed through was cancelling the move of County Hall from Morpeth to Ashington, even though a lot of the groundworks happened, everything like that, and also cancelling lots of building projects, including the expansion of Ashington Football Club and doing a lot of stuff around youth work and the reason for that was to save money. And and my wife and I were having this conversation earlier about how it's a really difficult situation, especially in politics. So it seems to be that 4 years seems to be the length of time that we've in the Western world have decided that people should be in power for. So, presidents are in for 4 years, potentially for two terms. UK governments tend to have elections after 4 years, etc., etc. But while that's great and means that you can vote people out pretty quickly, it means that quite often people spend 4 years unpicking the previous government's policies without actually really doing anything positive themselves. And I feel like that's definitely the case with education. I don't feel like there's been a whole lot of progress since I was younger. And in fact, the next link where we, it's actually from 2014. I don't know why this came into my feed this week, but it talks about teachers spending 2 days as a student and being shocked at what they learn. My son's now at the age, 10 years old in middle school, and he's starting to be really critical about the way that he's being taught.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of really good stuff that happens at his school, but I think there's one or two quite poor teachers, and he is not getting into lots of trouble, but is, I think, starting to display some low-level disruption because he's bored.
How old is he?
10.
Okay. What does this teacher say?
Well, I haven't spoken to them yet.
Not his teachers, the teacher in the article, man.
Oh, sorry. So this teacher, this is 2014, and they went. Did you do this when you were doing teacher training? Did you follow students around?
Yeah, I've shadowed teachers before, pupils before, not just when I was training.
Yeah. And how did you find it?
I find it really interesting. It's mostly bleak highlights, and it's like being at school again. I still remember being at school 30 years on, I remember sitting in some lessons, watching the clock tick by for every single minute of the lesson, the second hand, and keeping going around and around, doing counting games in my head and stuff like that, and being bored stupid. And I think that's what happens to a lot of them. I think you see, I think on one hand, when you start looking at the detail of the social dynamics within the classroom, you see how easy it is for a pupil to be disaffected with what they're doing there. And then also the quality and the content of the work they're being asked to do, it sometimes isn't up there and is really hard to get interested in. They're just doing repetitive activities of copying crap out into an exercise book and coloring it in or labeling it correctly and not really paying any attention to anything but their presentation, and sometimes not that.
Well, obviously this is American schools. I can remember, so I did follow people around while I was doing my teacher training. And I remember when I was just a regular classroom teacher, history teacher, and one kid who was a bit of a cheeky chappy, so like a little smile on his face, but totally meant it, was like, So you think you're really cool because you put all this stuff on the interactive whiteboard. What you don't realize, every other teacher does this, and this is all we get all day.
Yeah, exactly. PowerPoints, for example. Yeah. And everyone worked out how to use PowerPoint, and that's what it's good for. Watching, and if you watch lessons across the board, what you want to see is across a day, for example, is you want to see variety. And you're not highlighting the teacher's lessons. So you can't be, if your leadership team going in and observing lessons around the school, it doesn't really work like that, which is why learning walks became such a big deal in inspection, because you just get to get a 5 minute or 2 minute or 30 second snapshot or through the window snapshot of what's going on in the class. And why is it's not fairly representative? What you do get is a broad assessment, a thumbnail assessment of what's going on across the school and therefore what a child's day is like.
So there's three key takeaways in this article, and I think certainly if I went back in the classroom, I'd be revisiting this article, and I think that anyone who's listening to this who is teaching in any way should listen to this. So three key takeaways. Do you want to do these?
Key takeaway number one, yes. Number one. Key takeaway number one. Students sit all day and sitting is exhausting.
They talk about how tired they were and how, as teachers, we're on our feet a lot and we move around and we forget that kids sit still and have to ask to go to the toilet and all this kind of stuff. She says, if I could go back and change my classes now, I would immediately change the following three things. Mandatory stretches halfway through. They'll put a basketball hoop on the back of their door. They'd build in some kind of moving around activity into every single class day, that kind of stuff.
And yes, we would sacrifice some content to do this. That's fine. Couldn't agree more with that. That's what I've been trying to do. Obviously, I'm getting standing desks in the classroom. I'm still to make a success, but I now have a standing desk adaption thing on my desk. And so I stand. I don't sit in my lessons at all, except when I help a pupil who's sitting down. Sometimes I'll sit because my legs are a bit tired or whatever. But I'm on my feet all of the time. It's difficult to get them on their feet. One of the things about our school, I don't know if it's anything that contributes toward its success, but you have to walk a few minutes between lessons. It's not just like walking down the corridor. In the main, you have to move between buildings and public roads to get to another lesson. So it's not so great for, moving around, but it's good for the children.
Okay. Key takeaway two. High school students are sitting passively and listening during approximately 90% of their classes.
I'd say that's a sweeping generalization. I don't know. Sitting and listening is tough in my head anyway, unless someone's really good. So I was just looking at the timetable at the top, right? So the timetable they had to go through was geometry, Spanish, lunch, world history, integrated science. That's, four.
But look what time they start.
Subjects, 7:45, but they finish at 2:45.
Yeah, no, but for teenagers, that's the worst possible timetable.
That's probably true. It's when we have breakfast, 7:45 in our house. And the next day is math, chemistry, lunch, English, business. Yeah, get pretty old pretty quickly, probably.
Yeah.
But I think, isn't that so? I mean, as a teacher, I guess, so this is an interesting thing. I was just thinking about what I just said prior to this, and that about schools and what they're like. And actually, I'm a big fan of schools. I work in one. I have done for a long time. And I've worked in many. But there's still something in me that in my lessons, good or bad, and I'm not saying they're good, this is an important point, I try and make my lessons something that every individual in the class can enjoy for different reasons. It's entertaining, or it's got some real meaty stuff in it that's good to get into and get their heads into, or whatever. Or we're solving problems together, or we're asking questions together that are just like, really? And kind of thing. And it's not always on specification and things like that. It's quite difficult. But it's certainly, I think it's that. So I'm a big fan of schools, but I do work to make my lessons interesting. I am conscious of the fact that I want children to understand this. My classroom is a good place to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which other teachers aren't in that same way. They're much more like children, a slave to the agenda of qualifications in education. And the subject, indeed.
The author of this article says, I was struck by this takeaway, so the takeaway that they're sitting and listening for 90% of the time, in particular because it made me realize how little autonomy students have, how little of their learning they are directing or choosing. I felt especially bad about opportunities I had missed in the past in this regard. And then again, she talks about three things she'd change if she could go back and change her classes. Blitzkrieg-like mini lessons with engaging assessment for learning type activities. Setting an egg timer every time I get up and talk and all eyes are on me. When the timer goes off, I'm done. End of story. Because otherwise I can go on and on. Three, ask every class to start with students' essential questions or just general questions born of confusion from the previous night's reading or the previous class's discussion.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I know someone who was it? Was it Amy Burville possibly has a Wonderwall? Sorry, I keep mentioning Amy. Hello, Amy, if you're listening. It has a Wonderwall on the classroom when she used to be a teacher. So things where kids just could put post-its up with strange.
Oh, no, I've seen her. I've seen her do that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Right, key takeaway number three. You feel a little bit like a nuisance all day long.
And a lot of this is the sarcasm they talk about.
You mean the teacher's sarcasm?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know what you're talking about.
Well, I have to say, like, I am just naturally sarcastic. So I wasn't being, like, as a teacher, I wasn't being sarcastic in a malicious way. I was just being me.
But you say that. This is an interesting thing. So I'm, like, dead funny when I teach. Like, really, really entertaining. I make some really good jokes. I know how to insult people without ever insulting them, you know, in a way that they like. It's my expert area, I think. And I'm not being sarcastic. However, if you turn that over to the children's, one of the things, so on a bad day, I will just notice how much bollocks I talk. On a good day, I'll think I'm doing it really well. And then I realize that my profession is more to do with my mood or whatever and than it is to do with reality.
Definitely. That's one of the reasons I stopped teaching, because I felt like I couldn't be on stage all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's one of the reasons that I like the good holidays I get with where I work, is because I get downtime off that. So we just had our year 11 and year 13 have gone on study leave last Saturday. And so on Tuesday, I had a day with no lessons. Oh my word, because I live in a boarding house. So my weekends are busy with pupils. So having that day where I didn't have any, I had to go to chapel and have lunch with the pupils at lunchtime. But other than that, I didn't have any interactions with pupils. And it was quite nice. It was just knowing that I didn't have any scheduled on stage time was really good.
The last bit of this, so key takeaway three about kind of teacher attitude and sarcasm and feeling like a nuisance. The three takeaways here were digging deep into my personal experience as a parent, where I found wells of patience and love I never knew I have. That's really interesting. Did you start teaching before you became a parent, Di?
I did. And I was a better teacher after being a parent.
Yeah, I feel like that too. I feel like there's a certain, you know, anytime I talk to someone who hasn't got kids, I feel like I need to bite my tongue a bit, because I feel like it's a bit like any life-changing experience. You can't possibly convey what it's like. And so I feel like I'm being a bit patronizing when I say, oh, well, you wouldn't know what it's like because you haven't got kids. But it really is like that, isn't it? I mean,
I just have a golden rule. I never, ever talk about anything to do with my children to someone who hasn't got any. And that's the thing. So I always kind of see people who haven't got children as like they live in a really great place that I didn't get to live in. Do you know what I mean? It's like they're just nothing to do with me. It's like what you've got to say is irrelevant kind of thing. Because it's always a bit of grass greener thing, but it's always a little bit I don't know, this sort of range and wealth of what you get as a parent and how your mind changes. And as she talks about, that sort of those wells of patience and love that she didn't really know existed, they don't come. But I don't beget anybody who doesn't have that experience, who hasn't had children. I just kind of think you're not going to get it. But quite often, because
it's interesting because Theresa May, the Prime Minister, doesn't have kids, does she?
Oh, right. No, she doesn't. You're right.
And that was seen as a negative thing.
It was used, wasn't it? By yeah. It was.
But now it's being seen as a positive thing. Yeah. So it's one of those things. Anyway.
But I think it's interesting because also in my head, and I guess this is the same for everyone, I also wouldn't talk to all parents about some of the things that I would talk about parents. So with you, I would, I don't think there's anything that I wouldn't actually put on the table and say, let's kick this around a little bit. Mm. Because I found it odd. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, that's the relationship that we have. It's partly why we're here. Mm. But for a lot of parents, I would just think, you're never going to get what I say. Yeah. As well. So it's not just that. The last thing she says is that, two more things. I would make my personal goal of no sarcasm public and ask the students to hold me accountable for it, like a swear jar kind of style. It's not a bad idea.
Well, it just makes things fun as well. I think there was a phrase I used to say all the time, and the kids pointed it out to me. And so I was just like, right, you have to interrupt me and tell me not to say it every time I say it. And yeah, lo and behold, I stopped saying it because they told me to shut up, and it became like a funny thing in the classroom and whatever.
And that's good, but it also shows a different thing. So I'm always looking as a teacher with my classes. One of the things I find hard is to like keep making authentic connections with the children and that I teach and all the different classes. And one of the things I found is that if you give yourself to the classroom, it gives back, you know, they give yourself to the children. So having something personal that's real, a real development in your life or a real change you're trying to make or something, a goal that you have, sharing that with them is an excellent way of making that a real deal. And that's a mechanism for doing so, isn't it? You know?
And it's a while since I've worked in schools, but certainly I think when I was there, so many teachers don't talk about their outside life, which I think is a real shame.
Or being a person. They don't have to talk about their personal life.
No, exactly. Yeah, just fact that they don't live in the cupboard.
Yeah, exactly. And that possibly what's going on for them is the same thing that's going on for the children in certain ways, in different ways, but in the same sort of structure or something, or for their parents indeed, and that the children will be able to understand it and empathize with it. And that's what you're building when you do that kind of thing, is you're building a sense of empathy within the children.
Yeah, and there's a way in which you can talk about your emotions without being like, you know, an emotional wreck. You can remember doing a workshop where they were talking about the language of choice, but also how that makes me feel when you say that, and basically training them in empathy, like you say.
I read something that relates to this somewhere, and it was from a former head teacher of a big private school that someone else was writing about, and he said never punish a child not in anger, never fake the anger. And that's really interesting because you sort of, as a teacher, it's like, you know, you have your tools. And one of the tools is, I'm not angry, but I'm going to pretend I'm angry because this child is scared or does what I say or whatever. And he was saying, never fake your anger with a child. And I thought that was really, really interesting. So you never fake your emotions. It's really, really important.
Mm.
You know, to show, say, I was angry about that, but I'm dealing with it, or I don't know. You know, just
I'm not sure I agree with that, I have to say.
Yeah, no, I wasn't either.
Yeah, I remember. One of the scariest things you can possibly do, as you well know, Di, is to go outside, tear strips off somebody, and then walk back in the classroom completely calm and collected, because it scares the rest of the kids in the class to absolute death.
Yes, well, that was part of it. It was like when you're angry about something, be angry, because you're kind of, this was my thoughts about it. I was thinking, why is he saying that? Because you're in the moment, you're there. I mean, you obviously behave professionally within professional bounds, but you're there and you're angry because you're damn well angry. And that's the sort of thing that you would do there. But you wouldn't, to use that as a device to go and be really angry with a kid outside your classroom who doesn't necessarily deserve that anger that they're getting in the way that you're expressing it, is a really bad thing. It's like, So I've done this many times. I've done lots of things of pretending to be angry to try and make a class behave or whatever, and rarely is it successful. But it is very successful with an individual pupil. But what that pupil must feel is awful.
Well, exactly. And I didn't do it that many times, but it worked really well. It's funny because I've just been reading yesterday the essay by Montaigne, about, which is just called On Anger. It's essay 31 in book 2, if anyone's interested. And he goes through examples from history of anger, and basically people who were very in charge of their emotions usually would let people off and not punish them while they're angry. They made a thing of only punishing people when they yeah, when they were calm again, which I found interesting. Yeah. Anyway,
I'd subscribe to that in certain ways. It's an interesting thing. I don't think the answer's out there particularly. I just think it's an interesting thing to explore and kick around the table. You know.
No, I think so, and I think with my kids, I promised my son when he was 4 that I would never smack his bottom again, because I could see where that would end up in terms of him hitting other kids and stuff.
Yeah.
And I haven't since then, and so he and, you know, sister, who is a little angel to be fair and doesn't ever do anything wrong as far as I can gather, know that if I just say that I'm really disappointed, that's possibly the worst thing that I can ever say to them. But hey, right, so that third one at the end of this, so this is the third takeaway, and the third takeaway was you feel like a little bit of a nuisance all day long, and the third thing that this author would change about if she could go back into her class is...
I would structure every test or formal activity like the International Baccalaureate, the IB exams, do. A 5-minute reading period in which students can ask all their questions, but no one can write until the reading period is finished.
Oh, I didn't realize they did that.
No, I didn't either. Well, I know some people really rate the IB.
Mm. I've started to ask at the start of my kind of keynotes and presentations if anyone's come in to the room with a burning question. And most of the time they haven't.
Yes, you do that. I can testify to that, having watched some of them.
Yeah, and most of the time nobody has, but occasionally somebody does come in and they're almost just like it's welling up inside them, and they're waiting for the Q&A bit. So that works well.
Yeah, it's a bit like an interview maybe where you've decided who's got the job before you come in. You kind of know all about the stuff that you're going to say because you've done some research online and actually have some questions that need to be answered.
Yeah,
not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that was interesting.
Yeah. But so the next one is in The Guardian, and this is by Gabby Hinsliff, and she says, "Pity our children, they're being turned into grammar robots at school."
Well, that's interesting. Are they? Maybe they are. Does this relate to the... I wonder, is this going to relate to that article we looked at the other week where schools are basically great places for girls because they are the model, whereas boys find them dreadful? Is it going to relate to that?
Or I think it probably is, but I mean...
Grammar.
I'm not a fan of the argument that, well, I've never needed that in my working life, so why are you learning it in school? I think that's a really reductionist and pointless argument. We don't go to school just to learn things that we're going to do in our working life. That would be...
True.
Yeah. So, you know, you do advanced maths, even though you'll probably never do more than... Most of us will never do more than, you know, adding up and taking away and really simple, you know, multiplying and division. Mm-hmm. But you do it to expand your mind, yeah?
Yeah, indeed. Like, and also to expand, yeah, and so that you can take on things that you don't know what they're going to take on. So if you, when you come to do your first mortgage and you're looking at interest rates or whatever it might be, you have some kind of mathematical framework of knowledge in which to orient that.
Mm. And I think it's really important to be able to reflect, you know, when I talk about literacy and digital literacy, it's really important to be able to reflect on the fact that you are literate and part of a community of people who are literate and understand the terminology, syntax, grammar, vocabulary, etc. But I don't think that it's important to talk about fronted adverbials and split digraphs and some of the stuff that my 6-year-old daughter comes out with from school. I don't think that's a really important thing to do. And to me, it's the same kind of argument that Matthew Arnold and Thomas Henry Huxley had in the 19th century between a classical education and a scientific education. Uh-huh. And I didn't particularly agree with either of them in total, but the crux of the matter was, did you need to teach Latin in school? And Matthew Arnold said, yes, you do, because it's the basis of the English language and all this kind of stuff. And Thomas Henry Huxley said, well, if you want to teach English, you should teach English and not Latin to teach English. I'm kind of sympathetic with that argument. So where would you stand on that kind of stuff, Di?
I stand in a bad place, really, to it all. So because of my own education. So when I was, 14 years old or maybe older, 15, I was told after some kind of verbal vocabulary assessment that I needed to read the dictionary, which I did not do for reading. It's not something I did much as a child. But now my linguistic skills are strong, and you know, I do all sorts of things. I enjoy language. I don't study, but I take a keen interest in etymology. And I still have no idea about grammar. I think grammar, punctuation marks are toys to play with. Do I wish I knew more about it? I think I probably did. I have three children who all studied at Latin to A level. Did I pay any attention to any of it? No, I did not. But do I like linguistics? Yes, I do. So it's a difficult thing for me to answer. I have to say, I don't really know one way or the other.
Well, for me, this might not make any sense and might only make sense in my own head and probably not even there. But I see the world as a very dynamic, unfolding, changeable place. So I don't like anything which tries to set things in stone or to say that this is the way that things are. And, you know, recently I gave that keynote at University College Belfast. Queen's University Belfast. I do say that wrong often. Queen's University Belfast. And I talked about how digital literacy is always about power, and any literacy practice is about power. And so when people are talking about front-end adverbials and this is the way the language is and stuff, for me, the underlying assumption behind that is that this is set in stone and this is the way that things are now and for all time. And that's a very fundamentally conservative way of looking at the world. Uh-huh. Whereas, you know, I'm with people like Stephen Fry, who says, I don't really care how I spell. And, you know, as long as it's appropriate for the situation I'm in and I don't look stupid when I'm doing it, because language evolves and changes and stuff over time. And if I don't know what this thing is called, then, you know, I'll find out if I really need to. But if not, then I'll just get on with actually using the language.
Yes, I think that's right. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because Stephen Fry there is heralded as a bastion of the English language, if that's the right word to use, but a champion of it, you know, is probably the better word. And so I would see, I have this real thing. I'm really interested that there are a number of words that mean a similar thing and that there's one word to choose that can mean it right best. Yeah, the thing that you're trying to say and finding that word. So this is the deep and rich fog of poetry. So if you read poetry and you take time to read poetry, which I do not much do, you start to see how the author, the writer, the poet has chosen words so incredibly carefully, and that's meaningful. But I do like song lyrics, and I always have. So I'm really interested in people choosing words that are less and less generic and more precise and looking at the detail of the word and what the choice of that word says about what it is that they're trying to communicate. I'm really interested in that. It creates, however, a natural tension in that, whereas I want people to use words accurately and well, and I'm really interested in their stupid, fragmented meanings that sometimes happen. So I do cryptic crosswords, and you get a lot of that in there. But you have to allow people to be flexible and inventive with language, and allow colloquialism to happen for it to actually develop and change into what is needed for the communication of the day. And that's an interesting thing to me.
There's a particular paragraph in this article that I just read out. So this article, I believe, was published this week, so the 10th of May, so just over a week ago. It says, last week, the Education Select Committee concluded that the evidence did not show that teaching specific grammatical techniques improved writing, and it recommended that the new SPAG, Spelling, Punctuation and Grammar, test should no longer be mandatory for older primary school children. So that's for 11-year-olds, is it?
Yes.
Jeff Barton, the incoming head of the Association of School and College Leaders and another panel member, has described the tests as woeful. Ask around any school gate and the adjectives are less polite. Whoever is education secretary after June will face growing pressure to act.
I mean, you see, I would argue that, and I would argue I'm always coming from the idea of that the actual article where Jeff and fellow panel member describe these tests as woeful is entitled Jeff Barton says grammar should encourage pupils' love of language, not turn them off the subject altogether. And I would agree with that. So I come at language from like picking presents. You know, you choose a word carefully, with a desired audience in mind, and but also the intent of which you want the, of your meaning, and things like that. But to me, that's a really pleasurable process of finding the right word. And when you find it, it's like solving, it's like programming correctly. You know, when you find the problem in your code and it comes out right and it works, it's that little hallelujah moment.
Yeah, and just to definitely agree with what you've said, I've been in two very different situations where I've forgotten the particular context, but people have said that when they're hiring, if it comes between two people who are pretty much equal, they would always choose the person who can write better because it shows a clarity of thought.
Yes.
And I think the clarity of thought does not necessarily come through being able to know the names of each grammatical technique.
I agree with you completely, but it also, you see, this is one of the things. So good writing, we've probably discussed this before between us, I'm sure we have more than once, but good writing is an interesting beast. So when you read a piece of writing and you get it and it just flows and you just kind of write, you know, you read from beginning to end and you're just like pulled along through the paragraphs and you never think about length and duration of time spent reading. You only think you're engaged with the content, you're engaged with the writer's meaning, and it's superb.
Can you remember, and we'll not name names here, but can you remember an article that you shared with me earlier this year, and it was written in a very highfalutin style, and obviously by somebody who is very, very well educated and knows their grammar, but it was torturous to read and absolute bollocks.
Yes, I do remember that very, very well. And it was, and so that was, that article is a good case in point, because it had me at a crossroads in thought, a feeling, you know, when reading it, because it wasn't pleasurable to read, and yet the use of language was clever and witty, and not being funny. It was just clever and witty the way he had used words and chosen what content he was going to include. But it was all too, the article in its umbrella approach to me was all too kiss ass and naive to have allow it to have any merit.
It's a bit like, you know, I've been trying to dive into Stoicism and the writing of the ancients, you know, and I did my first degree in philosophy, so I'm always interested in this kind of stuff. And people have talked a lot about Cicero's writings, and there's a lot of it. I remember starting to read and thinking, am I just not getting something here? Because he seems like a really arrogant asshole who's just trying to sound really, you know, well-read and things. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, lots of people think that about Cicero, because that's, it seems, exactly what he was about. He was trying to talk about his legacy and stuff. Anyway, I think we're broadly in agreement on this.
I agree. let's move on. What's next?
So this is an article on the Priceonomics blog, and it interestingly talks about consequences for young people who are impulsive. One kind of sample group being rich and doing something impulsive, and one sample group being impulsive but poor. Again, it's America, and it talks about the difference in terms of what happens to you in those two situations.
This is kind of bonkers, isn't it? Is this stemming from the girl at Cambridge, who is Cambridge University, who is an absolute legend, apparently, is published, still an undergraduate, published scientific research in journals and things like that as an undergraduate, and yet still, but stabbed her boyfriend.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, yeah, she stabbed her boyfriend in an argument, and the judge basically said, you are such a talent, you're going back to university. We're not going to put you in a give you a custodial sentence, which is what you were going to get and would get for this crime. But we're not giving it to you because you're at Cambridge and you're brilliant and you're going to have this glittering career where you're going to help lots of people. So they
kept that out. Would seem to be completely unfair, yes.
So is that possibly one of these things of impossible?
No, I just looked, and again, this is something which, again, has come into my stream from a couple of years ago, 2015. So maybe if that was recent, then it wasn't about that. But
it's in here, isn't it? It's like the difference that happens from a rich kid behaving impossibly to a poor kid behaving impossibly.
That's right. So this basically is saying that where is it? 20% of our, so this is talking about prison, you know, or juvenile detention center in Illinois. 20% of our residents are criminals. They just need to be locked up. But the other 80%, I always tell them, if I could give them back just 10 minutes of their lives, most of them wouldn't be here.
Why?
Because they've made an impulsive decision, or they've done something a bit stupid, and it's affected the rest of their life. And the reason it's affected the rest of their life is because they're poor. And just as the perfect example of the judge there, some people deserve what's coming to them. Oh, right, you're poor and black, therefore people like you should go to prison. And other people, oh, you're white and in Cambridge, right, well, you should go back to Cambridge.
Yeah. I saw another interesting article, similarly, a girl at an American college did it this week. I think it was American college. And she took a samurai sword, a good, sharp tool, into her college and started waving it around like a mad fool, right? And she was doing this and then comparing that if she was of a different skin color and of a different gender and she had taken in a lesser weapon, that person would be in chains. It would have been dealt with. But no one ever addressed the fact that she had a samurai sword just, you know, in her college dorm and took it out and was messing about with it quite wildly in public rooms on the campus. So an interesting thing. And that is exactly what's going on. It flips back to what we were talking about earlier when I was talking about
So this is all about
institutionalized racism and such like.
Yeah, exactly. And this is this whole kind of article is around a paper by Sarah B. Heller, and it's based on a book by Daniel Kahneman called Thinking Fast and Slow, Some Field Experiments to Reduce Crime and Dropout in Chicago. So this particular paragraph, again, just to choose one paragraph to sum up the article a bit, to illustrate their theory, they offer an example. If a rich kid gets mugged in a low-crime neighborhood, the adaptive response is to comply, hand over his wallet, go tell the authorities. If a poor kid gets mugged in a high-crime neighborhood, it's sometimes adaptive to refuse, stand up for himself, retaliate, run. If he complies, he might get the reputation as someone who's easy to bully, increasing the probability that he'll be victimized in the future. The two kids, conditioned by their environment, learn very different automatic responses to similar stimuli, someone else asserting authority over them. End of quote.
Fight, flight, and freeze. Your choices in the moment, in those crunch moments, they become important.
And that automatic response is interesting, and I think it's possibly interesting for us, Di, because we've grown up in a much rougher environment than we currently inhabit.
Yes, to a degree, that's true for me.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know about you, but I've had to unlearn certain responses and behaviours over the years.
The one thing I can't stop doing, even as a professional at 46 years old, working in a school, is swearing. I'm really bad at stopping myself from swearing. I love it. And that's part of my upbringing. And my parents never let me swear at home, etc. So it wasn't like that at home, but it certainly was like that wherever I went to school. So that's the big thing. But I've never, I used to get into lots of trouble not with the police and not really at school, but I used to get chased a lot, get into sort of close calls, I'd say, rather than scrapes, you know, and I'd always be a bit cheeky as well, me and my friend. And he got beat up more than I did, though.
Well, maybe you would benefit, Di, from the Becoming a Man or BAM program. So the article goes on to talk about basically a program of CBT, like we were talking about before with the sleep app. And there's three particular things in this BAM program. One, recognize when their automatic responses might get them into trouble. So someone threatens you and you automatically like threaten them back. Two, slow down in those situations, behave less automatically. And three, objectively assess situations and think about what response is called for.
I think I think my parents brought me up in a different kind of culture to the one that I lived in. Do you know what I mean? And so I have access to these automatic responses that possibly people that go on this program wouldn't. And I would compare this a little bit to going on the speed penalty test when you get done for speeding, and if you were to go on a course for a day or an afternoon and look at actually what it is that you're doing, because as a speeder who has been caught going too fast on our roads, you have made a set of decisions and your judgments are wrong, and they go on this course. Now, everyone I've known who's gone on this course has said, actually, yeah, no, it's quite good. Because they feel as though they're actually being subjected to something, information that they don't normally hear and they wouldn't have heard otherwise, which is the point of them. Mm. And this could be a little bit along those lines, although, I don't know what the CBT part of it is really, other than just thinking about how you would respond in certain situations.
Well, I think the focus on this particular was, it says, what makes the interventions we study particularly interesting is that they do not attempt to delineate specific behaviors as good, but rather focus on teaching youths when and how to be less automatic and more contingent in their behavior. So removing the automatic, you know, you threaten me, I then raise you something else, and it just escalates and escalates and escalates, giving people a choice.
Yeah. Well, I certainly think, I've worked in some rough schools, and it says here that in the effective therapy on violent crime, so it gives a graph of the percentages of violent crime arrests among disadvantaged youths in Chicago under the BAM therapy program versus a control program. This is 2009 to 2010. And the percentage of those in the control group getting arrested for violent crimes looks to be about 17%. And those who have undergone therapy looks to be 8%. And so to say, you know, that's like half, and you don't know what's gone into that control group and that therapy group or whatever. But I would say I have met many children whom having the discussion about how they react to things on the street in specific situations that are relatively feral. For example, when I worked in Fulham, the kids would tell me about 3 o'clock in the morning, they'd all sneak out of their houses and meet up in the park, like 50 of them at a time.
Whoa.
That kind of is really feral behavior. And, you know, they would be smoking, taking drugs, having sex, drinking, and doing all the things they could at the age of 13, 14 or whatever. And it was quite difficult, and it was vertical, though. It was across the year groups. It wasn't just the I don't know, but it was. But I always thought, what the hell does anyone do about that? Because that's so much fun to a young person, being so damn naughty, doing all the bad things, all the good things. And what do you do about that? You know, and this is possibility because from my knowledge of it. If you're in a situation like I imagine it to be in Chicago, in certain areas where they'll be working in, life is pretty shit. Mm-hmm. And these things, these behaviors do not seem like choices at the time that they happen. And as you say, you get this impulsive a reaction that perpetuates your socioeconomic situation and removes opportunities for change from your life. Yeah. So maybe it's a really good thing. I don't know. It'd be interesting to talk to some people who've done it.
Yeah, yeah, and I kind of that whole psychological side of things really interests me. Anyway, let's move on. Tell me about 11-year-olds hacking their toys.
Oh, this is a cool little thing. Some kid, so this article's on securityintelligence.com, this 11-year-old proves that the Internet of Things security is no child's play, it says, because he hacked his teddy bear. So he was interested in computers and how they work from the age of 6 or 7 or something, his dad said. And all of that seems a bit nonsense. But anyway, he used a Raspberry Pi and he scanned the Bluetooth, the hall that he was in, at this big conference, and scanned the hall, found loads of Bluetooth connected devices and was able to get loads of numbers of people sitting in the hall, which was pretty impressive. And then he hacks his teddy bear to show how much these toys can how vulnerable they are to anyone and everyone who knows how to get into them, from the cars, for example, from lights to cars to toys, because everything has got a chip in it these days that connects it to the internet. So it's saying somewhere that the Internet of Things, which reached $16.3 billion worldwide spending on it in 2016, looking to hit $185.9 billion by 2023. That's a bit of a stupid prediction, but will indicate where things are going for the next little while. They're really quite vulnerable. Because of the news this week, we've obviously been thinking about how our Wi-Fi connected devices, our internet connected devices are vulnerable. Because what happened, Doug?
This was kind of a reason to not use Windows, and certainly not Windows XP. So as far as I understand it, there was a vulnerability in terms of SMB sharing. So if anyone's ever tried in the olden days, I guess, to network Windows PCs together, the way that you share files and drives across the network is using SMB sometimes. I think the Linux version of that is Samba. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There was a vulnerability which allowed attackers in. And what they did was they did a ransomware attack. So this vulnerability let them in, and then they automatically encrypted files and then demanded Bitcoin, which is theoretically untraceable, but from what I read might actually be traceable, to unlock the files. And the amount requested was anywhere from between, I think, $300 and $1,000. And this was pretty, it was a worm, so it was pretty indiscriminately sent around the web. And quite a lot of the NHS, National Health Service trusts, were affected by this.
They were in loads of countries. Over 100 companies, big companies, were affected by it across.
And it led to people being turned away from casualty and A&E and stuff.
Yeah, it's cardiac operations being cancelled in certain hospitals. So certainly it was quite clear. So I've had really interesting discussions about this while this has been breaking, so over the weekend and this week in class. And because we're actually, two of my classes are studying network threats at the moment, coincidentally. And it's kind of big deal and it's kind of not. But what it did, the conversations that we had were about how good is your network team in any one organization. So the vulnerability came in through unpatched software. As Tony Shepherd, hello Tony, if you're listening, pointed out on I think a Facebook thread, he got quite angry because lots of teachers like me who teach computer science are really quite fed up that schools were closing down the internet in the or closing down email or doing something and not disallowing USB devices to be installed and all that sort of thing, because technicians were panicking and thinking what we need to make sure that we're safe, and that's fine. And what Tony got annoyed about was people were slagging him off, the technicians off, so much. He's saying, look, they don't get paid very much, they're overworked, undertrained, underpaid, etc., and with unrealistic expectations put on their time, that technicians who work in schools, generally speaking, get off their backs. They're doing their best to make sure that everything is safe and secure according to how much they know, and just bear with it a little bit, which I thought was a really fair shout. So all of those different things happen in different places, but what it took, what I saw from the hospitals, it was like those who knew what was going on contained it and kept things up and running and didn't turn people away. But some of them obviously had different reactions, because it comes down to your tech team and how much they know and how much they're confident that their systems will stand robust. But it came in through I think it was a Windows XP vulnerability, which Microsoft have given up service for.
Although to their credit, they did put out a patch for it, I think.
There was a patch out for it in March for this very thing. But the point being is that a lot of people just don't deploy patches for different reasons, not bad reasons all the time. There's software out there that requires older versions of operating systems or certain things not to be turned off within an operating system that a security patch might insist on being turned off. So it's complicated, basically.
So there's a couple of things which really interested me about this. First of all, it's that the vulnerability was so... If you're an organization that wants to get into people's computers, then in the same way that people stockpile weapons, they stockpile vulnerabilities. And so the NSA had actually stockpiled this vulnerability just in case they needed to use it in the field. And it was then stolen from the NSA by the shadow brokers. This is in the New York Times article. And so the fact that the NSA is developing and stockpiling these vulnerabilities has been roundly criticized. And then the second thing, which was really interesting in a Hacker News thread, was a lot of these people were given, or organizations were given, 5 hours to pay Bitcoin to a particular address. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried to buy Bitcoin, Dai, but if you've never done it before, it's very difficult to buy even less than $1,000 of Bitcoin within 5 hours.
Agreed. And it's one of the interesting things. I don't know what the amounts are now, but on the close of play at the weekend, the 3 Bitcoin accounts that have been set up to receive money from these ransomware had earned just over $30,000 between them. Mm-hmm. And even on Monday, so I think when I looked at it last, it would have been Tuesday or possibly on Tuesday, and it was $48,000 then. And there are 3 Twitter bots are tracing the accounts to add them up. And to see how much money they're making. So people aren't paying, you know, they're not making millions. So if you look at other viruses that have made 300 million in 100 days or whatever, other versions of this. So
yeah, because of the verification we talked about earlier, you can basically, you'd have to set up 3 different accounts and link them together to be able to, you know, be able to buy the Bitcoin. So yeah.
Sorry, before we move on, interesting to note that the other, if you look at the other big worms, is they're also developed by the NSA. So Eternal Blue, which was the basis of this one, was for the NSA, and they used it, and then they discarded it, and it got leaked. That's, you know, Microsoft had patched it 2 months ago before it was leaked. It's not a coincidence, I wouldn't think. But also there's one called Stuxnet, another worm, that was the United States, to quote the article, United States and Israel used against Iran's nuclear program nearly 7 years ago. And elements of those tools frequently appear in other less ambitious attacks. But that's one of 3 worms that the Americans did exactly in that direction towards Iran's nuclear program, which you, by the way, don't hear much about anymore.
No, there's a documentary about that, which I keep meaning to watch. But
I've not seen. Yes. Okay, so...
Talking about hacking. A hacker has stolen, I think, 73 million... user account details from the education platform Edmodo.
Yes, so Edmodo. Have you used Edmodo in the past?
I have used Edmodo in the past, yes, early days of it.
Yeah, so I didn't stick with it personally, but I know a lot of teachers who did and really liked it, and I could see why they did. It just didn't fit into my plans at that time. The organization says it has 78 million members, a lot of children's passwords, a lot of children's usernames and email addresses. All the passwords have remained encrypted, they're saying, but those usernames and email addresses are out.
Yeah, so, I mean, fair enough. They haven't got their passwords, which means they can't log in pretending to be them. But they have got the people's usernames and identities of students, you know, we're talking about here. Yep. And I'm guessing that a lot of students won't have sophisticated ways of creating passwords. So, you know, it's not a stretch to think that there's marketplaces, as is in this article, there's marketplaces where you can buy this data. And if you cross-reference with another hack, then, and someone's got the same username, and you can get the password from the other side, guess what? They're probably using a similar password. So
yeah, that's what people do, is they have one password that rules them all, don't they?
Yeah. So
interesting thing. I tell people what I do, but I wouldn't dream of it. But I don't do what you do, which has the 16, you know, the LastPass password for every single thing. I use this, my own schema.
Right.
It's not necessarily a good thing.
Well, as long as you're not using the same password, I guess.
No, it's never the same twice.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure.
But yeah, just worth noting that if you're using a free service and it gets hacked, you've got no recourse really to anything.
Yeah. So get it changed. Get your passwords changed, and ideally do a thing.
Yeah. There is a website called Have I Been Owned? I think.
There is, yeah. We've talked about it before, haven't we?
Yeah.
You can just look up and see if your identity is part of the identities that have been hacked on the big databases like Edmodo.
Yeah, I will put that in I'll put that in the show notes. Okay, moving on.
Moving on, still around a little bit of hacking and coding. A fingerprint sensor on your phone is not as safe as you think. Well, I use my fingerprint sensor, but you don't use yours, do you, Doug?
I do not.
Scary statistic in this article, which is, you know what I mean?
Well, hang on, I'm still bringing you up because I'm doing the Have I Been Owned thing, but...
Okay, well,
I have heard this, but go on. Which one are you looking at?
It is that masterprints, so researchers from universities, have been able to develop a set of artificial masterprints, fingerprints that are like master keys, that could match real prints similar to those used by phones as much as 75% of the time.
Yeah.
So essentially, if they can do that, that technology will be out there on the market soon enough, and you'll be able to buy a thing that opens 65% of people's phones.
And as I've said a million times before... Right, you can't change easily your fingerprint. So, hey, if someone, like in the last example, somebody breaks in, my password is compromised, I can make a new password as many times as I want, but I can't change my fingerprint. Which means if somebody has access to my, I have fingerprint recognition on my iPad, but I don't use it. If I was using that and someone had managed to get into it and clone that. Then that's me owned for all time. Like, I can never use fingerprint recognition again.
Yeah, and that's the point. And I do think this because my fingerprint recognition system on my phone is incredibly fast.
Mm.
And I think, wow, that's really good. Then I think, hang on, it's reading such little amount of data. So it's more like a QR code than it is a fingerprint.
So this is the thing. When you talk about privacy to... You know, anyone who is a lover of Apple or Google's products or whatever, they say, well, it's not actually your fingerprint. What they're doing is they're taking data points from it and all this kind of stuff. And you think, well, that makes it less secure for a start. And then secondly, it's not like that's random bits of data. That's still based on your fingerprint. So I think there's a way to go here. And the fact that I don't use fingerprint recognition tells you all you need to know about whether I think it's a good idea or not.
Yeah, and so what I'd argue here is just put yourself in the phone manufacturer's shoes for a moment. Not that they should be wearing footsteps for a moment. If they are developing their phone and they want their fingerprint sensor and they want it to be completely reliable and really fast so that their users, they get massively good reviews for that part of their technology on throughout the web, etc., and their phone is a success, how do you do that? Well, you reduce the complexity of the fingerprint measure. So a way to test this is just to get your friends to try and fingerprint your phone, see if it works.
Yeah.
And you know, don't just do one, but do several, many different kinds of people you think might match and, you know, or whatever, I don't know, and see if it breaks it or not, see how easy that is. But with this master print, that could be a real problem, I think.
Yep.
Wise advice from Doug right there. okay, so in response to the hacker thing, I was looking around. I'm sorry about this 11-year-old learning to code. I signed up quite a while ago to something called Free Code Camp, which you've put an article in here about. So I was just watching it as something pinged through. They send me too many emails, to be honest, and something pinged through. But because it's connected to my work, I'm just watching how they're doing. The company's 2 years old only, and they've got this sort of revolutionary idea about how to get people to code, which is much more hands-off and doing projects than it is just stepping you through the code, kind of copy and pasty sort of type this and this will happen. They go and set you projects and they don't care where you learn how to do it. You can go and use Code Academy, you can go and ask somebody or, you know, do whatever you like, but you have to upload your project to their things to be certified. And as it's indicated in the title, it's free. Or no, it's not. You can pay for it. So there's an education package they put together where you can be pro rather than free. Mm-hmm. And it ain't cheap. It's like $5 a user a month. But this led me to a thing called CodePen.io. You ever seen this before, Doug?
I have, yeah. So people used to use this at Mozilla to share little bits of things.
Yeah, so it's basically three little windows at the top of your web browser screen. One with HTML code, one with CSS, one with JavaScript. And then underneath, you've got a big wide window that you can scroll up and down on to show the output of your code.
So what? How So I'll just describe quickly how I've seen this used, and then you can perhaps talk about how you use it. But I, for example, would be trying to do something with maybe a bit of HTML, CSS, maybe some JavaScript library or something, and I would have gone wrong, and I'd reach out to someone for help, and they would put my stuff into CodePen and then point out where I'd gone wrong and change the thing for me, and then I'd be able to see what I'd done wrong.
Yeah, and that's a pretty cool way. But I was, which is fabulous, isn't it? A great tool for doing. And I've seen a lot of people use the Code Academy coding windows in my classroom to do their coding, to actually code in it, because they get that really easy one window. Type your code here. Here's the result here. And so whether they're doing Python or HTML or CSS, whatever it might be, Code Academy has those tools on board, which is using, I'm assuming, similar code and tools to what this is. However, this one's just quite a nice layout. I like the fact, because I teach HTML, CSS, not JavaScript with it at the moment, but this would be a really useful tool to use with the children rather than running multiple windows all of the time. Yeah. And then they can save it and fork it. And it's also live on a codepen.io profile subdomain. So
have you used Glitch with them yet?
Glitch? No, I haven't. Is that good?
Yeah, so this is the thing from Anil Dash's startup. Not startup. What did it used to be called? It's just glitch.com.
Yep, got it.
So this, you can create little... you can fork people's bots and hello worlds and learn to code, and there's all kinds of things you can do on there. Pretty nice.
I see. That'd be good. Interesting. There's so much of this stuff out there. So I just saw this one. I looked at it. I thought that would serve a purpose in my classroom. And so
Glitch is basically what WebMaker should have been at Mozilla.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah. But, you know, some people didn't listen. Why would listen to educators? Sorry, bit of a snark there.
So Free Code Camp have put an article up that you've put in, which is called...
And I meant to try this weekend. So this is... Sorry, I was totally kind of top you there. About music programming. And for me, I find... If I had remained a single man longer, I would have spent a lot of my time doing this kind of stuff. In my teenage years... Oh, so Robert Miles died last week. Which is a big deal for me because his album, Dreamland, you know, I used Princess of Light in a media studies animation. It was the soundtrack part of my teenage years. I loved driving at night to that album. And I used to plug my MIDI keyboard into my Pentium 75 computer and play along with stuff and transpose things and whatever.
Okay.
And so for me, the kind of music programming, all this kind of stuff, Sonic Pi is really interesting. I know that Oliver Quinlan, hi Oliver, if you're listening, loves all this kind of stuff too. And this from Ableton, which is a Berlin-based music software company and kind of industry standard stuff, has this really easy to understand interface for programming music. So I guess it's the kind of thing my kids would love, but I haven't tried it yet. And I guess I'd use this in conjunction with GarageBand.
It sounds like a family event at the weekend. I think this is a great idea. I just want to mention about Robert Miles. He made a song called Childhood or Children?
Children, yeah.
Children. And so do you know why he made that song?
No.
All right. It's an interesting story. So over, is it in Australia or in, where was he based? In
Italy.
Italy, right. So in Italy, they had something called Saturday Night Slaughter. And what this was is so a lot of children.
Oh, is this the BPM there, thing?
Yeah, well, they're out there on class A narcotics, and they come out of the clubs hyped up to the nines, on their drugs, adrenaline pumping, come out of having a great time at the club, they jump in their cars, drive home, and get killed in a car crash. And to the extent, the number of children this happened to was so great, they called it Saturday Night Slaughter. Wow. So Robert Miles was writing this song at the time when this was becoming a big thing, and he changed its title to Children. And it was designed, so he was obviously very influential in the scene at the time, and so the club started playing it as the last song that they played before they turned off, you know?
So it's about 120 BPM, isn't it?
Yeah, and it takes it down, and it's like a, you know, it's the first proper chill out thing, but it's a solution to a problem that was Saturday Night Slaughter, where people were dying and being in dreadful accidents at the end of a big night out.
And you know, did it work? Because I never
thought yeah, that. Yeah, no, completely. That's why it's famous, because it actually did work and reduced Saturday Night Slaughter, because whether it was the actual song that did it and whether it had the influence that it wanted to, or whether it was the social attention that the song brought at the time and brought it, you know, start being safe, people, when you come out of these clubs and that kind of thing, I don't know. But certainly he did it for that, and it did have the right impact. So
when I, you know, looking back at what I had to do to get, you know, I remember buying a 20 quid, you know, 1990s, 20 quid for a teenager MIDI cable, just to plug my keyboard and stuff. And I remember my Monty Python appreciation site having to lug my computer downstairs to plug my VCR into my sound card to capture clips, and just how clunky and difficult it was. And these days, just things like this Ableton app and website and GarageBand and the stuff that Imogen Heap's doing, and wow, it's just what a time to be alive.
Yeah, and the stuff you can do, and this is amazing. So it basically says that if you are interested in music but have never been quite sure how it's put together and how its structure works, then this is the course for you. So do it. It sounds good. An hour well spent, I don't doubt.
Yes.
I wonder if something like stuff like this will come on, you know, for an hour of code. You know, that thing that's kind of didn't really happen this year, because it became a political beast, I guess. But the actual content of the stuff for an hour of code, I never thought was that much cop, but this might be really cool.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's definitely something I would point people towards. Cool. Okay. You've got some stuff in here. How are we doing for time?
Badly, as usual. It's a valuable resource.
Indeed. So we've got some stuff in here about, do you want to go through all of it? Maybe we should go through the Google I.O. stuff, or...
Google I.O. is VR stuff, wasn't it? So there's a really interesting, which link? Should we go to the VR twice as effective?
Yes, let's do that.
I haven't read this, but it just absolutely intrigues me. So this article is entitled, it's on thenextweb.com, Study VR Virtual Reality Twice as Effective as Morphine at Treating Pain.
Now, morphine is a pretty hardcore drug.
Exactly, and it's a massive... So I know that addiction to over-the-counter opioids in America is enormous because of the private health system. It says that there, a country with 5% of the world's population now responsible for consuming 80% of its opioids. It's clear we need an alternative.
Yep.
So I'm just pitch crudely here. So you stick on a virtual reality headset, and it immerses your senses to the degree that it manages your pain. Is that it, or is there a specific VR apps that are designed to deal with pain, or what's going on?
There's one called Snow World, and it says Snow World attempted to divert Snow World attempted to divert a patient's attention from the pain they were experiencing and into a magical world that saw them flying through a virtual canyon while throwing snowballs at penguins and snowmen.
Oh, what a thing to do.
Yeah. It's diversion. I mean, a while ago, I talked about some of the studies that Jane McGonigal had done around trauma victims. So let's say you've just witnessed your best friend die in battle, or you've just witnessed horrendous abuse or something like that. If you're given Candy Crush within, I think, something like 12 hours of that experience, it helps, it helps you not get as bad or at all PTSD.
Wow.
So it's basically distracting your brain from obsessing on about the stimulus.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting thing. Yeah, and that makes sense to me. Did you go to BET? You did. I know you went to BET.
Yeah.
Did you see the massive amounts of class sets of virtual reality headsets on offer for copious amounts of taxpayers' money or otherwise? Not a fan myself. You?
I guess I'm kind of with Audrey Waters when she says how problematic some of the narratives are around this, and I think this is definitely a killer app when it comes to medicine and health. I think with education we talk about virtual field trips. Well, here's an idea. Why don't we actually take kids on actual real field trips?
Yeah, all right. So you're a teacher. You've got 100 grand sitting in your budget. Do you buy a class set of virtual reality headsets?
No.
Right. So it's an interesting thing. So you think that about gaming as well. I listened to an interview with this guy. I can't remember who the hell it was. Some important dude. And he said that whilst gaming is perceived as a niche activity, it's like a geek thing. That's how people perceive it now. It is not going to be that. Gaming is going to be the way stuff is done, and virtual reality is part of that. And this is a possible example of it, is that the games that are out there at the moment are all kind of fantasy nonsense, potentially. But what's going to happen in the future is that games are going to be the way that we learn. They're going to replace books and stuff. And that's where all of this stuff is ultimately headed. Although I'll just counter that by saying, article I read today said how the Kindle e-book sales are down, and hard copies are up, papers up.
I think again, quoting Audrey, she talks about how the best way to invent the future is to issue a press release. And she's doing some work. I think she's got a fellowship, hasn't she, to track the predictions that have been made and whether they came true, et cetera, et cetera. The thing I think about VR, so Robert Scoble, who is a well-known blogger, et cetera, talks about spatial computing, i.e. things in the area around you, being the fourth generation. So we had command line, we had graphical user interfaces, we had touch screens, and now we have spatial awareness, things being context aware. Mm-hmm. Well, virtual reality is almost the opposite of that, because it's not like augmented reality where it's adding things to your environment. It's replacing the stuff in your environment, and that's really problematic because you can't physically interact with it, and you can actually be quite dangerous if you can't see anything around you that's going on. So I saw a Microsoft HoloLens at Thinking Digital. I didn't get a chance to use it, but they're £3,500 at the moment. This thing, as you'll know, Di, you can see through the glasses. It also has like Kinect kind of sensors, and it can sense the environment, and you can interact with stuff in an augmented, blended kind of way. And I think, fair enough with that, if you, for example, mix that with Lego Worlds that my kids are absolutely loving, and the joy they get through that, building stuff, going on adventures together, going through different worlds. They talk to each other to an extent that my wife's concerned about, when we get home from school, what are we going to build? What are we going to make? It's all about creativity that I just, having experienced that kind of joy of games when I was younger, I really get. Is it going to replace books? Are we going to be doing everything through VR? No. And I think that really AR is the way to go.
I think that, I think that's interesting. And I think possibly you're right. And maybe VR and AR will merge in some way. Just because if you're going to immerse the headset, you can also put cameras on the front of the headset and combine the two potentially. But in a sort of way that Google Glass would, or in different ways that have not yet been invented. And Google's input output IO thing was yesterday, day before something. They were hugely focused on augmented reality on your phone and going around and learning about the world through your phone's camera, I believe.
Because you can now search using your camera as opposed to typing things in.
Yes, effectively. And you're searching for all the things that you see around you.
Isn't that what Amazon did with a Fire Phone?
Did they? I don't know. Yeah. Did they do that?
That was the supposedly killer app of the Fire Phone.
Is that just products?
Could recognize things in your physical environment. Uh-huh. And you could either then directly go and buy them, or more often it would be just finding the Wikipedia article about them or whatever.
Yeah, so purchasing, it won't catch on if it's just like, because you can do that anyway, can't you, more or less, now, I think. But if it's telling you things about what's going on in your environment and like genuinely, when you point it at a tree and it tells you what tree it is or whatever, where you are, I don't know what it's going to do. So it's not something that really appeals to me enormously, because who wants to be walking around staring at their phone? Lots of people do, but they do it in certain places. No one really wants to walk around just looking at their phone unless they've got a little chat they want to have with another person, not because they're finding out about. It's a bit like going around, you know, when you go to a gallery or a museum or an exhibition of some sort and you get given a set of headphones and a radio and you listen to it on the way round. It'll be a bit, you know, life would become like that sort of, maybe. I wonder if that's what they're messaging. But I think there was mileage. This guy was talking about, like, gaming is immature or is not yet addressed the things that it will be used for in the future. I don't think it will kill books. I don't think books will die. I think it's an aesthetic process of reading a book, owning a book, etc. In fact, I once there was this one guy who talked in the article I read, who read all of his books on a Kindle, and then if he really liked the book, he bought it in paper so he could put it on his shelf.
That's what I do.
Is that what you do?
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
I buy a hardback.
Were you in the article? I just thought it was really, really interesting, and these things are up for play. So I'm always interested in technology that I think's rubbish. But this pain article, I mean, that's a really, amazing result, isn't it, for a piece of tech?
And it's a big deal. I've got a member of my family who has recently had to undergo surgery and was extremely intolerant to morphine, so was, you know, being sick as a result of the morphine, and therefore had to get a much lower dose, but then that was causing them huge amounts of pain. So something like this would be extremely valuable.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, I wonder if it actually allows you to treat pain. If you think about, like, pain, it doesn't really, you know, it kind of can come in waves, but the waves last quite a long time when your pain's quite serious.
Pain doesn't exist as an objective thing, does it?
Exactly. So people would have to, what, do you have to sit with a headset on all of the time? But the PTSD thing is really, really interesting as well.
Avoidance. That's in Jane McGonigal's latest book, which I've forgotten. Is it Super Better? Yeah, Super Better.
Cool.
Right, we should probably wrap things up here, but just to mention that, stuff we might get back to at some point, unless there's something. Is there something which really stands out, Dylan?
I want to talk about the Google taking over education.
Go on then, yeah. Okay.
New York Times article. So this is just a really interesting thing. So basically, it's saying that Google is ruling education at the moment, and if you look at the stats of sales of Chromebooks in America, you see what's going on. And it's done it in the last sort of 4 years or something. But the point is not that they're making money out of that, is that they're actually nurturing customer loyalty, and schools are actually endorsing this. So this is quite a scary thought when you think, oh my gosh, all of a sudden, 2017, the world is ruled by four giant tech corporations, and it's just getting more so, particularly Google, Facebook. Apple seem to be being quiet recently since they did the last MacBook Pro. I don't know if that's deliberate on their part or whether they're trying something else in the background, but but Google are very much on the forefront because of search, because search is the core of their business, I'd say. But what we're doing as educators is possibly pushing the children towards the largest tech corporation in the world that is only going to get more and more so, and as it stands, and making its position thing. So this was quite scary, and I thought, okay, but actually, let's not freak out. Microsoft, 85% of the operating system market share worldwide, et cetera, are they, you know, are we really in worry? We've been doing this with Microsoft for years. You know, the children take all their files away. They've been using Microsoft Office, using Windows, using Internet Explorer for many years. That started to diversify. That's a good thing. It's diversified with Apple. It's diversified with Google. Chromebooks, bringing an operating system into that equation as well, and obviously Linux has always been there.
So let me just read this bit, because I think this gets to the nub of the problem. Because as somebody, I think like you, Di, I've rolled out Google Apps, as it used to be called, across an institution for very pragmatic reasons. But just to kind of get to the nub of the problem, it says, Google makes $30 per device by selling management services for the millions of Chromebooks that ship to schools. But by habituating students to its offerings at a young age, Google obtains something much more valuable. Every year, several million American students graduate from high school. And not only does Google make it easy for those who have school Google accounts to upload their trove of school Gmail, docs, and other files to regular Google consumer accounts, but schools encourage them to do so. This month, for instance, Chatfield Senior High School in Littleton, Colorado, sent out a notice urging seniors to make sure they convert their school account to a personal Gmail account. This doesn't sit well with some parents. They warned that Google could profit by using personal details from their children's school email to build more powerful marketing profiles of them as young adults. My concern is that they are working on developing a profile of this child, that when they hit maturity, they are able to create a better profile, said David Barsotti, an information technology project manager in the Chicago area whose daughter uses Google tools in elementary school. That is a problem, in my opinion. End of quote.
I think it is in mine too, and that was a quote from the article about your opinion, not your opinion. But I think it is problematic, and so I was thinking about this, and I thought, right, okay, so we did this with Microsoft for years, like, you know, come and save all your files and take them with you. Didn't take your email with you. You didn't passage over the thing. We don't use Gmail in our school. We use Microsoft Exchange still. That's the thing. And that's a big concern that was just raised there, is that the mail, if you migrate your account and your mail history goes with you, that Google will use that to profile you, as not just your schoolwork files, if you see what I mean, your Google Docs and whatever. And so there's that. The other thing I thought about that is that we have a Google Vault. So then pupils would have to actually pay Google to have enough storage to take their stuff down. There's that. The other thing was, when we did the Microsoft stuff, there were other tools that you could use to read those Microsoft files, including Google Docs, but with OpenOffice, free tools, open tools. But there is no substitute for Google Docs. You can't take a Google Doc and pull it out. You have to do it within the Google Docs system and put it out into a format. Yeah. That is compatible with another piece of software, and you can't do that on bulk. So when you do Google Takeout, you won't download everything as a PDF, for example, so you could still read it and refer to it should you wish to. But so it's an interesting dilemma, and one worth thinking about.
It is, and the easiest thing to do is just to, as we've done, is just to go with these free tools which make productivity, and, you know, I use Google for my business, and find it really easy to use and stuff, but yeah, problematic when you're almost implicitly forcing people to use it.
Yes, this is the thing. That's the point. You're dictating to everyone to do this, and you want them to do it. But then saying that, I've never sent out an email saying, take all your files off the network, your account will be closed, or you won't have access to your account when you've left school. I've never done that. So people do it if they want, and they don't if they don't. I'm not going to make a recommendation. And we will naturally, because Google's storage is unlimited and free, we will just save their accounts and deactivate them, but not delete them until a certain amount of time has passed, I'd imagine. Cool. Was there something else I wanted to talk about? That you put an article in that's sort of relevant to that, which is about Microsoft being a kill switch.
Yeah, let's just talk about Microsoft being evil, and that'll do. I think we should probably wrap it up here.
Yeah.
I think just the takeaway is there are five big technology companies, and their software is eating the world. And if we think that they're being benevolent in any way, they're not. And just because something is easy to do doesn't mean it's the right thing to do, or just because it's possible to do doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. So I think we should be a lot more critical about our own decisions that we, you know, make about technology. And especially if we're making decisions on behalf of other people, we need to take time, and we need to think about, you know, potential unintended consequences.
Yes, we do.
Cool. Right, what are you up to this week, Di? We're on Thursday this week, so we usually record on a Tuesday, but it's been just over a week since we last met, and I guess we'll next talk next Tuesday. So what are you up to for the next...
Actually, I meant to discuss this, and I've completely forgotten. My apologies. So I was having a conversation with Drew Buddy and Tim Jeffress on Twitter just prior to the podcast. we were talking about the new non-examined assessment that's coming our way for computer science GCSE with OCR, the board that we all use, and setting up for that. And they've changed the rules of engagement under the new 9-to-1 GCSE. It's much stricter and harder to set up. And so Drew was saying it's dreadful. John Torbett as well was in the conversation. Hello to all of you, if you're listening and have got this far. I'm really sorry we didn't discuss it. We'll maybe discuss it next week because I think it's an important issue. But basically, it's whether it's of any use or not.
Cool.
So that's what am I doing this week? I'm finishing off that. I'm sending away marks to the board tomorrow for that, for the GCSE control assessments. And then hopefully I've got 1 week left until half term. So I'm hopefully just doing nice things.
Good. I'm having lots of conversations at the moment about what I'm going to do next in life, my career, etc. I'm happy enough and I'm earning enough and all that kind of stuff. But I'm doing little bits of things for people, and I want to get my teeth stuck into something a bit more. So I'm looking about me to see what that is. So I'm having lots of conversations with people at the moment. I'll be off to London to go to the Freeformers Future of Work Summit next Thursday, staying over at Brian's house, my mother's house, on Wednesday night. Hi, Brian, if you're listening. And also my son is playing football at the hallowed turf of your football team, Di.
You're joking, really?
Mm.
What a lad. That's going to be great fun, that is.
Yes. Well, as I said last week, I'm going to get him to wipe his feet as he comes in the house. we've also got a think-a-thon for an interesting security company as our co-op on Monday, which will be good. And yes, that's pretty much all I'm doing until we speak next. Right, yeah, so we might have to arrange a different time, but we can talk about that offline. Thank you very much for everybody who managed to make it this far. As ever, this is just goes on for as long as we want, really, and we're never going to really change that. So thank you for listening, and Di, have a wonderful week.
You too, Doug. Bye-bye, everyone. At the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on the dock of a bay.